there's moonbeams in your elbows, and there's rivers in your head. And I wanna see you forever, babe, forever. Don't take me back in time now, but there's nothing for me there.
Welcome to On the Wing podcast, fueled by Purina Pro Plan. You can consider today's episode the audio companion to the brand new film under the Careers for Conservation title, focused on Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever biologist Olivia Lappin. As the Careers in Conservation name implies, we're going to talk about breaking in to the conservation world as a career field. To help frame the discussion, I've got my buddy riding shotgun, Levi Day,
happy
as
to be here.
A co-host. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on with you, Bob.
It's been probably a year since you were on, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Are you ready for co-hosting duties?
I'll give it my shot. I mean, it's pretty big shoes to fill sitting next to you, but I'll definitely give it a shot.
For folks that didn't listen, last time you were on about a year ago, you talked about your role and Careers for Conservation. I think it was episode 262. Yeah, 262 is what I got written down. Give folks an overview of, you know, your path, your journey to conservation here before we dive into Olivia's story.
Yeah, it's funny. We were just having the conversation about being brief today, and now you want me to dive in. My story's it's pretty long and robust, but I'll try to keep it as short as possible. Really, just to give the Cliff Notes version, I spent a large amount of time in the education world prior. I'd always dreamed of having an opportunity of working within the conservation space, and found an opportunity and one day was able to capitalize on that, and I'm super excited to be here. My role now, it really lends perfectly into my story as well. The programs that I manage, my official title is Conservation Leadership Programs Manager, and the programs that I manage help to create opportunities for high school, college kids, people who already are within a certain career path to be able to find some sort of an avenue or a way into the conservation field. So it's incredibly rewarding and being really a living testament sitting here of some of the opportunities that can exist for people is really special to me.
So you've been in this role a year and a half-ish, right? How often do you hear people say, you know, I always wanted to get into this field versus more the adult onset thought process of, oh, I never even knew this existed?
I think, you know, I really get a blend of both. Mm-hmm. I probably have emails almost daily coming from either, you know, the high school or college students saying, if they're a high school student, what classes should I be looking at? What university, what programs, what can I do within the space? Or how do I work for an organization like Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever? And I do get people that, you know, like myself had dreamed of an opportunity and wanting to know more about my path, saying that it's, you know, inspirational in some way to them, and inspiring them to try to work towards it. So I enjoy that. It's a tremendous highlight really for me to be able to sit down every day and open up the emails and get to have dialogue with people and hopefully give them some direction and drive them towards something that they could be really passionate about too.
Well, Olivia, you're a biologist by training, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So our focus today is going to be on somebody that is what, in a career sense, probably what is the natural thought process. Get a career in conservation, you go get a biology degree. And that's what we're going to talk about. But I'm curious how often you get asked, Levi, the question, do I have to have a biology degree to get into conservation? Is that a common question in your field?
Yeah, without question. It definitely is. I think that traditional wisdom and thinking is obviously that if you want to work within the space, that having a foundation in natural resources or biology is a perfect segue into that. But what I always try to communicate with people is that having the people with their actual hands in the dirt and feet on the ground and putting conservation down our foundation, right? Like they are infinitely important. But along with that, there's a lot of other opportunities within organizations that act as cogs in the wheel to help deliver conservation as well. Mm-hmm. You can have a background in marketing or comms or, HR. And without programs or without having those other people in our organization, we wouldn't be able to affect the amount of change that we do. So it really takes each and every one of us. And we have a tremendous opportunity, again, as I'm not someone that's out there actually putting conservation on the ground, but hopefully continuing to drive the future forward and bringing more people in that can not only do that work, but can help to serve our mission and to deliver more conservation in their own unique skill sets.
Feels like there's two great fallacies when people think about getting a job in conservation and with an organization like Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever or Ducks Unlimited. You pick your favorite species, right? People think that I got to be a biologist, which we know isn't true. And B, they think, nonprofit organization and very specialized types of roles where they don't think about the organization as a business,
right?
As opposed to, just a charity, quote unquote, just a charity. Whereas we have to function as a business. The nonprofit isn't really accurate. We have to generate a profit. The profit doesn't go to shareholders, doesn't go to an owner like you would at Target or the New York Yankees, right?
Right, yeah.
But we have to generate a profit to fulfill our mission, and we have to function like a business. We have accountants, we have management, marketing, right? Like you pick your function.
Yeah. Yeah. Every representative is at the table within our organization. And again, without each and every individual person that we have, they all drive conservation forward, and we couldn't be as successful or reach the goals that we have in the future without them.
So, Olivia, thank you for being patient here. We're getting there.
Take your time.
I want to talk about the thought or the vision for this film, or what your thought process was, and then how Olivia popped into your radar. Before we go there, I want to thank the presenting sponsor of On the Wing podcast, Purina Pro Plan, also a national sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission. All three of my pups, Esky, Gitchy, and Winter, all eat Purina Pro Plan, not just because Purina supports our wildlife habitat mission, which is incredibly important to me and it should be to all of our listeners, but what's most important is that Purina has the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food. It was built, it was created for the working dog. Learn more at ProPlansport.com. All right. The journey to careers in conservation, this film concept, what was your vision to create here, Levi?
So ultimately, I think there's a lot of conversation around the organization of trying to focus on telling our story. I think that we continually strive to do a better job at that, and we've done really well, but I think that we can, there's always room for improvement. And being able to put together a film that told a different aspect of our organization, of maybe some of the positions that we have that aren't always front and center, and could highlight some of the work that we are doing that a lot of people might think of as a bit on the periphery. Being able to come in and tell that story and to continue to show how we are making a difference all across the landscape, not just in, the heartland of pheasant country, but all over and in many different ways that most people, might not be familiar with. And the more that we can tell that story, it does nothing but benefit from every aspect of what it is that we're trying to do.
So we have hundreds of coworkers.
Yeah.
And yet Olivia percolated to the top for this effort. How'd that happen?
That's a great story. So initially when this project kind of came.
Do you know this story, by the way, Olivia? Do you know how you got picked?
I don't think so necessarily. They just reached out and asked if I wanted to do it. I was like, yeah, sure, come on down to Mississippi.
Interesting. All right. Sorry to cut you off.
No, it's great. So originally when this opportunity kind of came across my desk of something that we could do to better tell our story, we wanted to think about a way to, again, highlight some of the positions that we have. And there's a bucket full of them that maybe a lot of people aren't as familiar with as we would like them to be. And it just so happens that we have some really charismatic, great people in those positions. Some of our future plans potentially with these films highlight some other great individuals as well. But there just was some names that were kind of floating around. And when some of them came across my desk, I just started, you know, really putting the feelers out with other people in the organization that had time with these people and tried to learn as much as I could about not only the work that they were doing, but I was looking for people that lived our brand, mm-hmm. that are authentically passionate about the work that we are doing. And even if, God forbid, there was some reason they weren't with our organization anymore, they were people that were going to be living representations of somebody that cares about conservation and about wild places and about the incredible animals that we have on the landscape here. Mm. And time and time again, when I reached out, you know, Olivia's name kept coming up. So I had the opportunity then to reach out and have a phone call with her. And I was equally as impressed with her and her willingness to jump in and just do whatever it was that we need. We bombarded her house and we're down there. We bombarded her house and interrupted her life and
tried to get you to try sweet tea and you did not like that.
I'm not quite there yet.
It took me a while.
Northwest guy going to the Southeast was a little bit of a different experience, an incredible one at that, but definitely different. But no, it was remarkable. She surpassed every expectation I could have had in going down there. The ecosystem definitely surpassed every expectation I could have had. It was just an incredible experience all the way around, from the people that we had the chance to work with, that Olivia works with directly, or some of the landowners and the other facets of her job that we had the opportunity to interact with. It was an incredible trip, and I cannot wait to be able to push this out and really tell the story of not only Olivia, but our organization again, and all the things that we're doing.
So here's where I invite you to become the co-host. And if I miss any questions, feel free to interject. And Olivia takes the center stage as our featured guest now. So tell us your backstory, you know, where you grew up. Kind of your family dynamic. Bring us up to the point where this became a field for you.
Yeah, so growing up, I was a pretty outdoorsy individual. I didn't really grow up in a hunting family per se. My dad was kind of a fisherman. He would go shark fishing on boats off the coast. So I'm from Maine, so fishing was pretty big. And I went out with him a few times, but it was more my older brothers. I've got two older brothers. They were kind of the ones that always did stuff with dad. And most of my childhood was outside, whether it was with my friends or my cousins. My dad's side, we've got a really big family, so we'd always have family gatherings. And I just remember going to my nanny's. She lives up the road from me, and we'd go out and just spend hours trampsing through the woods, rolling over logs and looking for salamanders. That's what we would do. And so we'd do that, and then there'd be little ponds and rivers, so we'd be catching frogs and snakes. I mean, you name it. That's what we did. And either that or building forts, you know, your typical childhood. I feel like that's a lot of people who probably listen to this podcast or can relate to the same thing. You were outside running around barefoot, the whole thing. So I always kind of grew up being around nature, enjoying that. And I also grew up riding horses. So I was always kind of an animal lover. I started riding horses when I was 5. So between that and the just being outside with animals all the time, I enjoyed, that's kind of where I felt, I felt the most enjoyment being out there. I'm kind of an introverted person, which, you probably wouldn't believe, because I feel like I can talk your ear off, but I found the most peace and enjoyment being outside. And so all of that, and then just kind of the love of animals, and just helped to transition me into, you know, throughout high school and everything, I was kind of the save the animals type person, very anti-hunting. Tried to be a vegan for a while. That didn't last.
Very anti-hunting.
I went through a stage of, just it wasn't for me. I was not into it. I kind of felt like, why did I, as an individual, have the right to take the life of something? And I kind of always had that mindset, and it just wasn't for me at all. I didn't, like I said, I didn't really grow up in a hunting family, and so it just wasn't something that I was exposed to ever. So all I knew from it was what was told to me, you know, from movies or whatever, you know, Bambi, your typical, you know, your typical story. So,
what did you think you were going to do as a career during those high school years?
Yeah. So, I worked on a small family farm. It's called Smiling Hill Farm. I volunteered there when I was 14, again, because I loved animals, and I was like, I just want to go take care of animals all the time. So I did that. And then that turned into a job throughout high school. I'm very thankful I never had to waitress or work in a store. I just got to basically pick up poop for a living in high school. So that was great.
A lot of people might trade you on that.
I know. But it was great. And so I always knew, you know, I definitely wanted to work with animals. I loved it. And so I looked at, you know, veterinary. Mm. That's kind of your typical, you know, if you want to work with animals, you go to be a vet.
Sure.
That wasn't really what I wanted to do. I couldn't see myself doing that. So that didn't really fit. I had toured a couple colleges, meeting with different people in different departments to just talk with professors. You know, what is this job, or what is this field actually like? What kind of careers can I get from this field? And so the vet didn't really seem right. And then I looked into animal science, because I was like, okay, that animal's in the name. What might that be? And I kind of got different responses on that. One person said it was, you know, they had an animal science degree, but they spent most days working with mice in a lab. And so I was like, oh, you know, that sounds not fun either. So then I was looking just at different schools, and I saw wildlife ecology listed at the University of Maine. And was kind of looking through their brochures, looking at the classes that you could take. And I was like, well, that sounds amazing. Like, you can do that as a job. And so kind of just fell into that direction. And then they also had on their little brochure at the bottom was a picture of somebody holding a black bear cub. And they had me at that. So I was like, if I get to do that senior year, I'm going to go. I want to hold the black bear cub. So, So I went up to UMaine for 4 years and studied wildlife ecology. And that was great. So, yeah.
So you have a 4-year degree from University of Maine in wildlife ecology.
Yes.
And had you done an internship or anything like that during that time?
Yeah. So our professors, and I'll say this, you know, about UMaine, they were very good about pushing us to get field experience outside. There's only so much that you can learn in a textbook, especially when it comes to wildlife. I mean, Levi, you were talking earlier about boots on the ground and everything, and there's only so much you can learn from a textbook. So they were constantly pushing us to go out in the field during summers between classes and get different field experience. So between junior and senior year, I basically was scrolling job boards. I think it's like the Texas A&M job board. Mm. I look at that thing, or did, religiously. Scrolled through that and found an internship position over the summer working on a seabird island off the coast of Maine. And I knew some other students previously that had done that. It was called Maine Coastal Islands National Wildlife Refuge. And they are great about hiring basically inexperienced students to do really cool field work. So I lived out on an island for a couple months in the summer. It was just me and one other biologist in a tiny little shack. We had a small mini fridge, a little camp stove, bunk beds, an outhouse, and that was it. They'd boat water and food out to us.
So let me make sure. So you're in Maine.
Yes.
You're going to the University of Maine. Mm-hmm. You found a job on the University of Texas A&M?
Yes.
Website to go work in Maine on an island.
Yes. Yes.
And who's paying, what's the entity of the island that was paying you to, or employed
It was the
you?
Fish and Wildlife
it
Service.
Was the Maine Fish and Wildlife, or the U.S. Fish and
U.S.
Wildlife? Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So that was why they posted it
as
a national. Okay.
Yes.
Interesting.
But even Texas A&M, I feel like that's kind of the go-to now. Like if you're looking to get into conservation, they post everything.
Is that true?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Texas A&M's website.
So we actually use their job board as well to post our jobs within the organization. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It's a major hub for anybody looking for opportunities in the conservation
space. That somebody is going to take away one nugget.
There you go.
Texas A&M job board.
Yeah. No
bookmark
kidding.
It. Save it on your phone.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. That's pretty much where I found, I'm pretty sure, like every single one of my different internship positions.
Really?
So, it's probably where I found this one, honestly, I think.
Huh.
I don't know. But yeah, so that was a great first internship. And again, I was a complete, you know, inexperienced biologist going into this, and they dropped you on the island. They said, take these notes, ban these birds, you know, put different tags on them to track them. And it was very intense field monitoring. We'd go out every day and weigh the seabird chicks and take measurements of them, and we would set out in a blind for hours doing foraging studies, watching what the parents would bring back the chicks for food. And it was very intensive, but I was basically sold on birds at that point.
It ground me in exactly when this was in college.
Between my junior and senior year.
Okay.
So the first 2 years of college, I still worked at the farm because I was like, I love this. And I don't, you know, I didn't feel the pressure yet to take an internship because it's hard to find decent paying internships.
Sure. Yep.
So I was like, I'd rather make money for school than do that. But then the pressure kind of kept getting put on me. Like, you really need to build your resume.
Yep.
Like, you really
get that experience, separate yourself from the crowd.
Yeah, exactly.
So you did.
Yes.
And then you go to your senior year, right? And thought process mentally, right? Like, at least I wasn't a biologist, but my thought process is time to go get paid, get a real job, right?
Yep.
What was your thought process?
So, yes, definitely was looking for something full-time. However, to be fully transparent, it's very hard to get a full-time job in the wildlife field if you're going straight biology. You mentioned earlier, Levi, all these different routes that you can take. But if you want to be, you know, in the field studying animals, it's a very competitive field. I mean, who would not want to work with animals for their career? So it's a very competitive field in that aspect. So I ended up doing multiple different internships until actually landing a full-time job. So after senior year, I graduated, took another internship at a wildlife refuge, also in Maine. It was called Moosehorn National Wildlife Refuge. Studied fish, birds, bats, bees. That was all kinds of different things while I was there. And that was about, I think, 3 months.
And that's also with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yep.
On a refuge?
Yes. And that was really great just to gain different experience with different species. I mean, before that, of course, birds were the only thing I had worked with. And I really wanted to kind of put my feet and dip my toes in different waters to see what species I wanted to work with. It seemed like everybody when I was in college had their thing. There were the fish guys, there were the deer guys, the duck guys, you know, everybody had their thing. And I liked it all. Like, there was not one species that I wanted to work with. I think you could put me studying anything and I'd fall in love with that species. So I'm very easy to get sold on studying something specific. But anyways, so I took that one, and then after that, I actually saw on Texas A&M job board a job in California to go out there and did a weird job that really isn't wildlife related. I did backcountry fly fish guiding, mule packing, the whole thing, taking people out.
You were guiding fly fishing?
Yes. Well, I'm not an expert fly fisher. Okay. But we would take people to the places to fly fish and then send them on their way while we just would keep camp and, you know, make meals.
Because at this point, you're not hunting or fishing a whole lot.
No, fishing a little bit. College at UMaine, when it's wintertime, if you don't ski, you pretty much ice fish. It's one or the other. So I spent a lot of time in college ice fishing. Totally loved that. Got hooked on that. Really didn't get introduced to fly fishing until I went to California. I mean, my brothers did a little bit, and I tried to pick it up, but honestly, I didn't have the patience. I just got it hung up on every limb and was like, this isn't for me. So
yeah, it's interesting. I'm just sort of tracking the progression, right? Because you know, where your story goes with the film is you went from anti-hunting to, you know, you're putting a lot of food in the freezer. And it seems, based on the film, like this is a big part of your identity now.
So, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
That's definitely a part of the story I'm excited to hear about, too. I've been so fortunate, you know, to hear Olivia talk about her fascinating story multiple times, but I don't think we've ever been able to really divulge. And my classy co-host here is probably going to need to have a whole nother podcast with you, because I think it's a fascinating topic when we talk about somebody that has made that transition, who is such an active participant, not only from a professional standpoint, that working within an industry where hunting is obviously at the forefront of conservation and what we do here, but personally, like a very accomplished, continually trying to work at her craft as an outdoors woman, and watching that and hearing and seeing that transition, I think would be fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's a transition that a lot of people in my field do. Like it, a lot of people go through the same process. When I was at UMaine, I don't think there were many people that hunted in my classes. Everybody kind of fished a little bit, but hunting was not.
Women and men.
Yes, yeah. Not like it is where I am now down in Mississippi, or not like I'm exposed to now. Really, people weren't into it. So I never even really had people offer to take me. That opportunity just wasn't there. So I know a lot of different organizations do, you know, hunting courses in college, and sure. I think that's huge to get, especially if you're in the biology field. Like, you should absolutely be exposed to hunting while you're in school, because I mean, if your family doesn't do it, then you kind of have to rely on other people to take you, and finding people is difficult. Even when you are into hunting, finding people to mentor you is
right.
It's very difficult.
I have a question for you then. The educator in me just continues to pop up in this, that, and maybe you don't remember, so it's okay if you don't, but were they not teaching like the North American model of wildlife conservation in these programs?
They were. I had a couple of classes that covered it, but it was just touched on, I'd say. Okay. It was not the forefront of most of what we were being taught. I'd say when I did go, so kind of fast forward a little bit, when I went to Mississippi to get my master's, I'd say down there it seemed more in the forefront. And I don't know if it's because people in Mississippi are more into hunting and it's just something that is more prominent. I don't really know. It's actually something they had put out a survey about UMaine, and that was something I suggested. I was like, we should highlight more about how hunting and conservation are related, because that's something I mean, it was undergrad. I don't know how much I really paid attention necessarily to every single one of my classes. So it could have, you know, it's a policy class. I could have just, right. You know, missed that part. But
it is interesting, though, because perception as a person, Midwestern, you'd think about Maine. It's like, well, Maine and hunting are synonymous. Like, it's right. Part of the fabric of the culture there. But not necessarily the case.
Yeah, no, I was looking back. It's surprising. I really can't name maybe two people I knew that really did much hunting. It was mostly upland, like rough grouse. Yeah. That was usually the thing. Deer hunting wasn't a big thing. Turkey hunting wasn't really a big thing. It was mostly rough grouse, more uplands, upland style. So
help us get to Mississippi, because you got us to California. But Mississippi, it feels like, based on the film, based on the little that I know about you, created a major shift in your life.
Yeah, so between California and then Mississippi, I did a bunch of other internships.
Really?
I'd say a handful. I had gone to California a second time, Northern California, doing like wild horse elk interactions and watering holes. That was a little bit for a couple months. I was in Delaware working with a grad student who was doing research on turkeys. So we were rocket netting turkeys, tracking them, and that's kind of what inspired me to go towards my master's degree. Mm. He's like, yeah, you know, in the wildlife field, it really helps to have that higher education, getting that secondary degree, because you usually, when you do that, if you do the thesis route, you're doing a whole research project from start to finish. And it's just, you gain a lot of valuable skills, whether it's public speaking, going at different conferences, talking about your research. It's a really valuable skill to get your master's degree. So he kind of inspired me to do that. So I kind of was looking on Texas Job, A&M Job Board again. They're going to love me after this one.
Sponsored by.
And so I saw a master's position posted, and it was, I don't remember what the title was, but it was studying northern bobwhite quail at Mississippi State University with Dr. Mark McConnell.
Huh. And had you ever seen a bobwhite quail before?
No. I had to Google what a northern bobwhite was. Like, I'm not even ashamed to admit that. I was like, I don't know what a northern bobwhite was. So I looked it up, and because, I mean, we don't have them in Maine. So I've never grown up. I'm so far out of that culture of quail hunting. So, no, I didn't know anything about them. And so I applied to it just because I liked the research question. It was looking at their calling behavior and roosting behavior. It was going to be out in the field tracking them. I was like, well, that sounds really cool. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll learn a lot about a new bird species, and was already hooked on birds at that point. So applied for the position, interviewed with Dr. McConnell, and he accepted me to it. So at this point, I was in California, so drove from California to Mississippi, packed up my car for like the millionth time. I've already driven across the country multiple times, so drove down there and started that, and was there for about 2.5 years finishing that degree. And
so Dr. Mark McConnell has been on this podcast before.
Yep.
He's very connected with our organization, is a great partner of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. So he's in the circle. Have you ever asked him, like, how did I get this master's gig?
I actually have not. I have no idea.
Oh, we got to do that. Yeah.
I really don't know. Because, like I mentioned, wildlife is a competitive field. There's usually, mm-hmm. especially master's degrees, because they're so limited. You know, funding for wildlife is such a limited thing. So finding funded research that, you know, I didn't have to pay to go to school. So that's really fortunate to have that opportunity to go there and get higher education and have this experience without having to pay out of my pocket to do it. But positions like that are really hard to find. So I don't know. I'm guessing it's my long resume of a million things.
So that was going to be my next question. If we take a moment here, looking back on this phase of your life, if I'm a student in high school or early college thinking about Olivia's story, it's like, holy cow, all these internships, not getting paid and being able to pay off student loans, super intimidating. And then thinking about, oh, and then I also have to go get a master's degree to compete to get a paying job to pay off student loans, maybe fall in love, buy a house, like live a life. That whole component of your journey is daunting. It's intimidating. What advice would you give for Olivia back in high school? That would you follow the exact same path? Would you guide yourself somehow differently?
Yeah, so I think about this like every day of my life, how fortunate I am to have had a family to support me and had the means to be able to move across the country a million times, take low-paying internships. Basically, I would take an internship between those school years. That little bit of money that I would make from the internship, I'd put right towards a student loan. So mm-hmm. I wasn't making any money at this point. Again, I'm fortunate that I was still living with my parents. Mm. I had a roof over my head. You know, I didn't have to worry about sources of funding. Mm-hmm. So, and I know that that's not the case for a lot of people.
Right.
And it's unfortunate that that's the case. But I was fortunate to be able to do that. And, you know, definitely advice that I would have is, and something that I see a lot is people wanting to find positions where their home state is, which I totally understand, you know, if you're married and you've got kids, or even if you're just really close with your family, but it's very difficult to find a wildlife job in the state that you're in, unless it's, you know, again, it's competitive. I applied to a lot of jobs in Maine back in, you know, when I was trying to find something full time before I did all the quail work, and mm-hmm. I could not land a job. I could not land a full time job. It's just so competitive. I'd always get to the interview process, and they'd be like, "You're a great candidate, but we already know this person," or mm-hmm. you know, it was very difficult. So the major advice I have is if you're able to, be willing to move to different states to gain opportunities, and don't be picky about it. Like, if you really want to say work with wolves, you know, it's very hard to find a job working with wolves because mm-hmm. everybody wants to do something like that. But you have to be open to taking different opportunities to help you get to that point. You know, we talk a lot about in this position, and I hope, or I wish that I had more experience in the agriculture field, because that's something that I have to deal with every day, is working with landowners who are often producers. And right. I don't have that background at all. So even if you're not traveling across the country to go do some cool field job working with elk or something like that, and you can only stay near your house, you can gain valuable experience in positions near your house. So I just say, be open to the opportunities that come to you. Don't always feel like you have to do all these different wildlife internships to build your resume, because there's so many other things that you can put on your resume to make you stand out that aren't just, oh, I studied this species. Because once you study one, it's kind of all the same. Mm. You tracked turkeys, you tracked quail, it's the same thing. So it's almost getting different skill sets beyond that, you know, public speaking, sure, working with landowners, all of that's really going to help build a resume beyond just your classic field work.
You talked about all these different internships. Was there a gap in time between when you graduated from undergrad and you decided to take the master's at Mississippi State, correct?
Yes.
What's the gap in time between those two?
There was never. I was always somewhere doing an internship somewhere. Okay. So, yes, I graduated, and then it was always, I mean, there may have been like a month here or there in between where I'd go back home to Maine. But when I was nearing the end of one internship, I was already applying to other internships.
But what about from undergrad to your master's? Was there, did you graduate and then immediately apply and go to a master's?
Or? No. So I did, I wish I knew off the top of my head. I probably did 1.5, 2 years between undergrad and then
of
grad
different
school.
Internships to build,
yes,
your experience.
Yes, and it's like a couple months here doing this, a couple months here doing this.
And do you, so thinking about those two routes, like a student that, you know, all this advice, go get your master's, go get experience, would you recommend somebody jump from undergrad, immediately go to their master's, or is it the experience of the internships more valuable? Like, which adventure would you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would, if you have the opportunity given to you, and this happens to a lot of undergrad students, is they are really close with an advisor, they've already done undergrad research, that's a great opportunity to get right into a master's degree if that's the route you want to do. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of undergrad research projects that you can work on. I didn't do that. I kind of wish I had. Mm. But it just depends. If the opportunity is given to you and you definitely want to do your master's and you can jump right from undergrad into that, do it. But also, it was nice for me to take a break from school.
Sure.
I think I would have been burnt out going right from my bachelor's to my master's, because 4 years in school, I mean, by the end of it, you're like, I'm done. Like, I don't really want to do that anymore. So I think it was nice to do some different internships. And then it also helped narrow down specifically what I wanted to study, because mm-hmm. when you choose a master's degree, that's your life for 2.5 years.
Right.
You live and breathe your thesis research. Yeah. So you really want to at least partially like what you're researching. Yeah. So if you jump right from undergrad to a master's and you don't really like your master's project, it's just nice to kind of figure out what you want to do. And so I had known that I probably wanted to do something with birds.
Right.
I was open to other opportunities, but birds was kind of my thing.
Yeah. When I hear your story, I kind of, maybe I have a different optic on it. What I hear as far as advice for people is saying yes, right?
Absolutely.
Your story really does outline, you know, tenacity, perseverance, like these incredible traits that I think are unique to your story. And they're not unique to other people probably within the organization, or not our organization, but they want to work within this space. But I also think it is still your unique story. At the end of the day, you knew what it was that you wanted to do with your life, kinda,
yeah,
right?
Definitely,
because it's taken
kinda.
A lot of turns, and you having the self-confidence to say yes while having that underlying driving force and knowing that in some way, shape, or form, you wanted to work within this space, whether it was with state agency, federal agency, an NGO, something. You continued to show that perseverance, and your path may not be the same as other people's, but I do think the big takeaway, you know, because it can seem very intimidating if I was, you know, a senior in high school and I'm hearing about all the things that you have to do. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the world of education, and I'm sure we can all remember back to when we were students. And if someone said, you know, I want to make doctor money, but I don't want doctor school, you know, and to hear you, like, holy smokes, you have doctor school. Mm-hmm. If you add it all up in a timeline. And though that was true for you, I think there is other avenues, but you continued to persevere and say yes and let life kind of go in certain directions. And I mean, the evolution from where you started as mm-hmm. a senior in high school to where you are now because of those characteristics that we outlined and just being willing to say yes is remarkable.
Yeah, and something that I can hit on here too is it's builds so much character. The person I was graduating from undergrad is so different from the person that I am now. I mean, the passion for wildlife, you know, that's all still there, but getting those experiences, and I was fortunate again to be able to go out and do all those different internships, but being able to experience just different areas like California, living around, it was a very livestock heavy area that I was in. So constantly working with farmers who had totally different viewpoints than I did. I mean, again, this was kind of early in my career where I was like so anti-cattle and cattle ranching. Mm. And so immersing myself into their world, just it educates you in a different way again than a textbook could. I feel like I really got to experience different, you know, different cultures, different people. And I wouldn't trade that for the world. And looking back, I lost a lot of friendships in, you know, leaving undergrad and everything, because it's so hard to, mm. I mean, how do you maintain friendships when you're never in one spot for more than sure. a few months? I'd gain friends, you know, doing different internships, and I'm still in touch with a lot of them, but you're constantly moving around and, you know, family, you're apart from your family for a long time. And so there's kind of a lot of sacrifices that you make, but what you gain from it, doing those different field experiences, I mean, I would not trade it for the world. Mm-hmm. I couldn't imagine what my life would be like if I didn't say yes.
Hmm. Pretty easy choice for the film.
So tell us about Mississippi State and falling in love, if I can put words in your mouth, with quail, and when hunting enters the picture for somebody that was only a few years prior kind of anti-hunting.
Yeah. So when you're studying bobwhite quail, of course, it's a game species. So I kind of knew going into it, I was going to be exposed a lot more to hunting. And I think at this point, I can't pinpoint exactly at what point I was maybe interested in hunting. Hmm. I think it was mostly for the sourcing local food. I kind of went through that phase where I was like, I want to know where my food comes from. I don't like going to the groceries. Like, I want to raise my own chickens and have my own farm. Like, sure. So I think that kind of was always kind of subconscious in my brain that I wanted to do that. But it wasn't until somebody invited me to go hunting. I got invited, so I did my master's research at this place called Prairie Wildlife in West Point, Mississippi, and they were great over there, and they invited me to go duck hunting in Louisiana at a place called Honey Break, and so they invited me down there, and this pretty much was my first hunting experience ever, and I mean, I was spoiled for a first duck hunting experience. Mm. I was so captivated by the beauty beyond the hunting. Mm. It was going out there at sunrise, the ducks flying overhead and the sound of their wings. And it was beautiful. It was such a amazing experience that I feel like going into it, having a biological background, having a biologist background, I feel like I view things maybe a little differently than somebody who has only hunted has. Because I'm looking at everything. I'm looking at the plants in the water. I'm like, oh, what are they feeding on? And I'm looking at just all these different aspects, you know, the different sounds that they make and everything. So I feel like when I go hunting, I think I view it a little bit with a different mindset, because, you know, even if I'm turkey hunting in the spring, you know, turkey hunting and there's birds singing all around me, I cannot go for a simple walk in the woods without IDing every single bird that I hear as I go on a walk through the woods. It's honestly frustrating sometimes because I just want to go and relax. And then if I hear a bird song that I don't know, I'm looking it up, trying to figure it out. It's like, can I just relax for once? So I just feel like you know, it kind of, I look at it with a different viewpoint, mm-hmm. I guess. But that duck hunting experience was really great. And I just was captivated by going there, not even shooting anything. I just liked being there. And so kind of just had different hunting opportunities come up from that. And
so one part that you didn't spend any time on, it's interesting, and that's the thought process of, oh, I got to take Hunter's education and, you know, gun safety and learn how to shoot. And I have to imagine that was a mental debate.
Yeah.
You.
So I guess I forgot about this, honestly, until you mentioned that we, when I took that first internship on the Seabird Island, part of the job was trying to keep away nuisance gulls and birds that were eating the eggs of these, you know, threatened and endangered birds that we were studying. So I actually took hunter safety for that, for that internship. And we learned to shoot 22s and I mean, we shot seagulls.
Yeah.
So I guess I did do that before, but I never hit anything. I was a terrible shot. So
yeah, you're probably the only person that first time they went hunting, it was for seagulls.
Yes. I
did not have that on my bingo card, Levi.
Yeah, that would have been a good one.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I had already got that. But no, as for like actually hunting, it was just, I think the opportunity just was never there. I think if somebody had invited me that I trusted and I knew was a genuine ethical person, I think I would have gone. Mm. I just never had the opportunity. And I think that's really huge for people who are into hunting now. And for myself too, is even if you think somebody is not into hunting,
mm-hmm.
offer for them to go,
mm-hmm.
to just sit and watch,
mm-hmm.
to experience it. Because I think going with a good mentor, because I'm sure there is, you know,
poor
mentors.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Finding and going with somebody that's good, I think, can really change somebody's mindset.
Mm-hmm. When did you first hunt quail?
I have not shot a wild bobwhite quail.
Oh,
so
really? Have
no.
you tried?
No. I don't have a bird dog. So
okay.
It's, I will never ask somebody to take me hunting, ever. I don't do it. So it's always
but
just kind
of. But if somebody
been,
asked you to
yes.
go, you don't have a problem with hunting quail.
Yes. I just don't. I don't want to say, hey, can I use you and your guide and your dog and can
mm-hmm.
can you take me? I just would never ask that. So I just haven't had the
opportunity.
Because
you feel it's a big imposition.
Yeah, like I don't want to ask that. And people like their little secret hunting spots. And I just feel like I'm imposing by asking, can I go? So, no, I've never shot a wild bobwhite quail. Prairie Wildlife has, you know,
right.
your typical game birds and everything. And so I'd shot a few there. But honestly, maybe three like pen-raised quail just through my lifetime. But no, I've never done any upland hunting beyond rough grouse in Maine, pheasant in South Dakota. Twice I've shot two pheasant. And that was through this position.
We
had a seed team meeting up there and we were able to go pheasant hunting. So again, you know,
yeah.
we're being around people that have dogs. It's nice. Yeah. We were able to do it.
So I'll take us back to the career path then. So Mississippi State, you get your master's. Then is the next leap to our organization?
Yeah. So when I was at Mississippi State, of course, I was interacting a ton with quail biologists, people in the quail world at different conferences, meetings like NBGI meetings and everything. I was always around PFQF biologists and they all seemed very happy with their jobs. They seemed genuinely happy about the mission of the organization. They were happy to be doing their work every day. And I was always intrigued by what their, you know, what their work was, whether it was farm bill bios or, you know, state coordinators. And so I was always kind of leaning towards working for the organization just because I had heard nothing but great things.
Huh.
And then, of course, like you said, falling in love with quail.
Mm-hmm.
I had never seen them, never heard them or anything, but following them around in the grass for 2.5 years, I feel like I learned those birds like the back of my hand. Their vocalizations, because part of my research was looking at bobwhite calling behavior. So we would use Bluetooth speakers with playing a female call off of it to try to attract males to a net so that we could capture them, put a radio collar on, and track them. And so it was so cool when we'd get a quail very close to the net, and they would do these really different soft vocalizations that are not your typical bobwhite calling. And it's so quiet that normally you probably would never hear that. And it's very similar to turkey hunting. You know, you're trying to call this bird in, you're working with them and playing different calls, trying to get them to come to the net. And they're funny birds. They never cease to do something unexpected. And I love that about them. I had one bird that was radio collared that just one day he was in the field. He spent most of his time in. He didn't travel very often. He just was always in this area. And then one day I couldn't find him. Tried to go around the whole property with the telemetry, could not find this bird. And then he just randomly decided to go more than 3 miles just off the property. And I don't know, you know, why would he do that? And he went from great habitat to a fescue cow pasture. And not surprising, he ended up dying a few days later because there was hawks everywhere and he was in terrible. So it's like, why?
Yeah.
Like, why would they do that? And I just, I feel like I'm always asking why did they do certain things. And I had one, I guess, little side story here. I had one bird when I was calling the male in. I didn't realize that he was already with a female. So they were kind of obviously together and she was a radio collared bird that I also had. And so I knew she was incubating a nest in that area. And so I guess they were kind of co-incubating and hanging out by this nest. And I didn't know he was the one that flew into the net, but as he's flying into the net, I can hear her like screaming her head off. Like, why are you leaving me? Like, why are you leaving me for another woman? And he just flies over. And so it's just funny. You know, I know you shouldn't.
That's called anthropomorphism.
Yes, yeah, I know you shouldn't do that, but I couldn't help but think that that's what she was saying. She did not sound happy that he left. So, no, I just, they're such a interesting bird. And
yeah.
I mean, I'm so glad that, I'm glad that I said yes to the opportunity because I didn't really want to go to Mississippi. I'm from Maine. The thought of Mississippi was not, you know, too hot for me. I don't want to go there. So I'm glad that I said yes to that opportunity to go there and do that schooling and endure the hot summers. And I'm really glad that I went to all these different conferences and met people within, you know, Pheasants and Quail Forever. And so I started, you know, nearing the end of my master's degree. Of course, at this point, I'm like, all right, I need a full-time job. Like, at this point, I'm getting tired of traveling around. I'm like, I just want a full-time job and to stay steady in a place for a little bit. So I, you know, again, Texas A&M job board, sorry. As they were posting different positions, and I did. I applied to a handful of different ones with Pheasants and Quail Forever, and I didn't get some. I interviewed, and I didn't land positions. You know, there were obviously other really great candidates that were getting them, but I didn't give up because I knew that this was the organization I wanted to work for. So I just kind of kept applying to different positions, and none were kind of falling on my plate. It wasn't working out. So I ended up accepting a different position with Bird Conservancy of the Rockies. They're based out of Colorado, and it was a very similar job description. It was working out of an NRCS office helping landowners. It was very similar to like a farm bill biologist position. So graduated, finished my thesis, and then drove up to South Dakota. And then spent a year there in that position, starting to kind of work with NRCS, understanding the landowner aspect. And
was that focused on sage grouse?
No, it was just general. There was no like specific species for it. It was a lot of grassland restoration kind of work is mostly what our contracts was, prescribed grazing, that was sort of thing. And so I didn't love it. I loved where I was. South Dakota is beautiful. I would move back there in a heartbeat. Beautiful state. I wasn't sold on the grazing. It wasn't fueling my fire, I guess. So I wasn't super big into it. The organization was great. They did really great work. It's just where I was, whatever contracts were coming into the NRCS office, I wasn't really sold on. So still was kind of looking and then saw this position open up and applied to it and ended up landing it after a few interviews. And so then went from South Dakota and moved back to Mississippi. And so now I am here again, or back in Mississippi again.
By this position, you actually have two business cards to fit your whole title on.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, I have two business cards.
Your title, Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, Integrated Habitat Management, Right of Ways and Energy Coordinating Biologist. Somebody should ask me for a little help with this title.
Yeah. But then I always have to add in and seed team conservation specialist in the Southeast region. It's like, how do you even?
So tell us what your job is.
Yeah, so when I applied to it, I actually didn't know really about the seed aspect of it, the seed team. I thought it was just Rights and Way and Energy. That's kind of what I was applying for. And I've never worked in that kind of space before, working with different utility companies like transmission, solar, pipeline, and I had no experience.
And for clarity for the listener, it's planning habitat, wildlife habitat, within energy spaces, so underneath the power lines.
Yes, and so that's what kind of sold me, was because I hadn't experienced that, and I've never seen a job listed doing habitat work on rights of ways. I was like, well, that's really cool. That seems really novel. I don't hear a lot about a lot of organizations or people doing that kind of work. So it just sounded really interesting. And of course it was with Pheasants and Quail Forever. So I was like, this is perfect. It's a really cool job that's different and with a really great organization. So that position is really focused on working with different companies, basically working with them to come up with management plans to better manage the rights of ways that are good for wildlife and also save them money in the long run. I think it's like 35 million acres across the U.S. that are just right of ways. And you think about it, it's kind of wasted space.
Mm-hmm.
They just get mowed all the time. And that's pretty much the only management that they get is getting mowed. So what tweaks can we make to manage it better for wildlife, with early successional vegetation being something that's so limiting now? Those areas, because they have to be maintained in that short vegetative state, they're perfect areas to have early successional vegetation, which quail need, pheasant need, and a whole host of wildlife and pollinator species rely on. So with that many million acres across the U.S. in rights of ways, why are we not tapping into that for wildlife management?
So to bring this back to listeners that maybe have heard us talk about the habitat mosaic on this On the Wing podcast and past episodes, so that we think about the habitat mosaic, where there's great big blocks of habitat and wildlife management areas or waterfall production areas that create anchors of habitat where, birds nest and there's winter cover. And these right-of-ways function very similar, to buffers and roadsides. It's the same thing. It creates corridors of connectivity to big anchors of habitat that it's functionally the exact same thing. And you can plant it to pollinator habitat, nesting cover, you name it. It just is a different way to approach a similar concept.
Absolutely. And something too, so my first year in the job, I went to Tennessee, and with one of our partners, I went out and I did vegetation assessments along the right of way, and it was a lot of invasive plants, a lot of undesirable woody species. But then there were some that I'd walk on and I was like, oh, this is actually not bad. There's a lot of really great native plants here that are just somewhat being choked out by invasive species. So it's like there's so much potential if we could just remanage them a little bit different. So a lot of what we do is basically coming up with management plans of, here's what you're going to spray, when you're going to spray it, how often, and basically directing them to, instead of mowing it, here's your new timeline, and then trying to see, hopefully, it goes well, and hopefully we get a good response from those native plants that are in the right-of-ways already, that are just kind of being suppressed by all those invasive species that occur because we just mow these areas, long tracks, and we just spread that invasive seed all over the place. So, that's I really enjoy that part of the job, and then the seed side is a whole other wheelhouse.
So I know we're getting up against the clock.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the seed, and then we'll work towards a close because I know you got to get to a meeting.
Yeah. So the seed side, like I mentioned, I didn't really even know that that was a part of the job until I got the job. So it was like, here's a surprise.
Sounds like a bait and switch,
yeah,
Diva.
Yeah. But I love that part of the job. Honestly, I like the right-of-way side, but I really love the seed team side because pretty much every day I'm talking with different landowners who are so passionate about managing their land, whether it be for quail to get quail back on their properties or if it's turkeys or deer or just pollinators or they just want to plant native. It's so fun to basically talk to all of these different landowners and hear their story, hear about their properties, hear about their passion for managing their land. And then if it's so, you know, if the property requires a seed mix to be planted, in some cases, there's already a really great seed source on these properties. You just need to thin out the timber or do some different management to have great habitat. But in some cases, you know, after new developments or something like that, you don't really have great seed anymore. Old crop fields, you know, old ag fields that just there's no native seed left in there. We'll work on developing different native seed mixes for each landowner property. So if somebody's got a really wet area that holds water, you know, I'll custom design a mix to have species that are a little bit more wet tolerant and just making all kinds of different seed mixes for landowner objectives and trying to make them affordable too. I mean, native seed is astronomically expensive and it can be difficult to get. Like this year, butterfly milkweed is very expensive because there wasn't a good crop year on it. It's hard to get that seed source. So it's constantly every year tweaking seed mixes to be what's good for the habitat, but also isn't going to completely make a landowner go broke trying to seed their property. So
as we close this and I think about the film which I watched and I think about your journey and I listen to you, you seem happy. It feels like you said yes a long ways, but you had tenacity, you had perseverance. Is that true? Are you happy in your role?
I would say that I am very happy. I really wouldn't trade this for anything. I feel like I'm living what my high school animal loving self, like I feel like I'm living my dream. I love it.
That's awesome. Any last bit of advice for a young Olivia listening?
Just say yes to opportunities. Well, any opportunity that comes your way, just try to take it and see what you can learn from it.
Outstanding. Congratulations. Not everybody can say after, you know, a couple of years that they've hit exactly what they want to do. That's wonderful.
Yeah. And you know, got to have their story highlighted and told. And it's one that deserves to be told. There's such a genuine authenticity and joy that comes from you every time that I'm around you. And it's something that I'm super excited to share with everybody, not only her, but again, the great work that we're doing within the org. So it's been an absolute pleasure for me to be able to go on this journey with you. So thank you, Olivia.
Yeah, and thank you for letting me, you know, tell my story, because to me, that's just my life. Like, I don't look at it as anything worthy of telling, but if it can inspire other people kind of in my position to, I know it's cheesy, but follow their dreams of what they want, it may take a little bit of a different path than what you think.
Speaking of following, are you comfortable sharing your Instagram handle for folks to follow your adventures?
I don't know what it is, actually. I think it's like, I think it's olappin1, maybe olappin. I think it's olappin1.
We'll leave it in the show notes for folks to follow, because you get some great photography and you take great adventures. The film Careers in Conservation, from the vision of a Levi Day to the journey of Olivia Lappin. Wonderful story. Thank you, Olivia. Thank you, Levi. I'm Bob St. Pierre, reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks, folks.